The treatment strategy of adjuvant endocrine therapy has undergone a revolution in the last 5 years, not only because of the introduction of aromatase inhibitors in postmenopausal women, but also the long-term perspective on management of ER-positive disease. I met with Dr. Kathy Pritchard for her take on the many new trial data sets addressing these issues, and she began our conversation by commenting on the initial choice of treatment in postmenopausal patients.
I think the adjuvant endocrine therapy area has been really exciting. It's pretty clear now that every postmenopausal woman in the adjuvant endocrine setting should have an aromatase inhibitor at some point. I personally tend to start most of my patients off on an aromatase inhibitor, not totally, but more often than not. But I think either tamoxifen for 2 years or 3 years followed by an aromatase inhibitor, an aromatase inhibitor from the get-go. And it's very clear that adding an aromatase inhibitor at the end of 5 years or 2 to 3 years of tamoxifen is also additionally beneficial. And what's come down the pipeline around that in the last 2 to 3 years is that as every one of the three different agents are coming through in these different settings, they all seem to be useful in each setting. What we're still really waiting on is the data that might tell us whether it's as good or even better to start out with a year or two of tamoxifen, whether there's priming going on or something like that, and then to switch over to an AI or not. And also, what do you do with a patient who's had 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor? Is that too long, just right, not long enough? And there are going to be a lot more trials randomizing patients after that time.
I want to pick up a little bit on the practical aspects of some of these questions. Now, first, in terms of this issue of are there patients who should be started on tamoxifen, postmenopausal patients, right now in your practice, are there any patients like that? And if so, which ones?
Well, the spectrum of side effects, of course, is different for tamoxifen and an AI. If you have a patient who doesn't have a uterus but really fears osteoporosis or already has bad arthritis of some kind, which I don't think necessarily makes them more likely to have the aches and pains you sometimes see with an AI, but it may add on to something they already have and worry about, there may be patients who'll choose tamoxifen and who are well-suited to have it. It's still a very good drug. Or patients that you're not completely sure are right into menopause. If you have a patient who stopped having periods after chemotherapy, is 52 or whatever, that may be a good patient to give a year or two of tamoxifen and then switch them when you're sure they're in a menopausal situation.
You referred to the issue of the duration of AI therapy. How do you approach that in a non-protocol setting?
Well, it's been totally arbitrary that we studied 5 years of an AI. But the data we have, certainly from MA17 and I think from other studies as well, it's been very clear that year over year, continuing to give letrozole, at least in that setting, you get additional benefit with each year. And it seems to be steady up to 4 years of follow-up. So my own idea of this is that it may be good given indefinitely, but right now what we've studied is not more than 5 years. And so I would be stopping patients or putting them in a clinical trial at the end of 5 years of an AI.
Do you discuss the option of continuing?
Yes, I do. And right now, actually, in Canada, we don't have either of the trials open that are going to randomize patients in that setting. We will in the next 3 to 6 months. I hope have both of them open. But until then, I've been giving patients a little longer AI and hoping to put them into a trial.
You mentioned two trials. I know the NSABP study. What's the other one?
Well, the NSABP will randomize people to 5 more years of letrozole or not if they have had any endocrine therapy that adds up to 5 years and includes an AI. Whereas there's a re-randomization arm of MA17, and that re-randomizes all our women who have been on 5 years of tamoxifen and 5 years of an AI as part of the MA17 study to get or not get more letrozole. But now we've got an amendment to that that will randomize anyone who's had 5 years of an AI to more AI or not. So it, to some degree, would overlap with the NSABP 42 study, but not completely.
You know, I remember when the duration of tamoxifen was being looked at, and we went from 1 year to 2 years to 5 years, and then there was a point in time where people were saying, well, this is chronic suppressive therapy that needs to become indefinite. And then, you know, the NSABP trial came out and it suggested a detriment to continuing, and everything sort of fell off the table there. But I'm hearing rumors that, even though it's kind of antiquated, we're going to start to get a final answer to this tamoxifen question. What do you know about that?
Well, I know that there's two large trials that have gone on in Britain and Europe, not in North America at all, I don't think. The ATOM trial and the ATLAS trial. And those have randomized women who've completed 5 years of tamoxifen to 5 more years or not. I think that some of the results of those studies are going to be published or presented in the near future. And I think the suggestion certainly is that there's not a negative effect to going on longer. And there may be some positive benefit, but I haven't seen all of the data. I think the big thing that is probably still true, as far as I know, is that there was a huge amount more benefit when you went from 2 years to 5 years. But going beyond 5 years, I don't think the amount of benefit was as clear, at least. And that's probably because tamoxifen somehow takes on some agonist properties after some period of time. You could theorize that none of the AIs are going to do that because they're a different kind of drug. And that giving them maybe the longer the better. But then I remember when everyone was saying that about tamoxifen too.
You mentioned the arthritis that's seen with the AIs. Can you talk about your own experience with that and what we know in terms of its etiology and management?
Yeah, I don't think we understand it well. And there seemed to be a spectrum of activities. I realized just recently while looking through a couple of the trials again at side effects, something that the penny hadn't quite dropped to me, that women are getting more carpal tunnels with the AIs than placebo or than with tamoxifen, which was something I hadn't realized. But the most common thing we see is a sort of syndrome of aches and pains, and I don't know how else to call it. It's sort of an arthralgia myalgia, but not an arthritis. And if you look at most of the controlled studies, it's only in about 5 or 10% more in the AI arms. I believe it's a real syndrome, and some women get it quite severely. And I suspect it's similar to the aches and pains that some women describe around menopause, and that it's an estrogen deprivation symptom of some sort, and that some people get it, and some people don't seem to get it at all. And a few people get it very severely, and some patients, I try taking them off, switching them to another AI, or switching them back to tamoxifen. And some of them, it seems to dissipate, maybe with the switch, maybe not. I think some of them get it with every AI, but don't get it with tamoxifen, and that may be another reason for going back to tamoxifen.
Another issue that's come up about AIs, and you've actually published on this, is this question of cardiovascular disease. Can you kind of review that, not only in terms of overall what we know, but what we know about the three different agents?
Yeah, I think the three different agents are not dissimilar from how I would put the data together. There have been, up until very recently, and there's still no data, no direct comparisons of the three agents, one with the other, in the adjuvant setting. And those comparisons are going on, and we'll get that information. But the comparisons have been an AI to tamoxifen or an AI to placebo. And really, there's only been data on the AI to placebo comparison in MA17. And there's really no difference in cardiovascular events, no difference even in lipids, in the lipid sub-study of that study. Whereas I think in pretty well all of the studies of an AI versus tamoxifen, there's some additional cardiovascular events in the AI arms. And in one arm, it might be cardiovascular deaths. In another trial, it's MIs. I suspect that's a function of the way the side effects have been collected and categorized and so on. I think that there's been plenty of data around before to suggest that tamoxifen was somewhat cardioprotective. It lowers lipids. In fact, for the amount it lowers lipids, one might have guessed it would have been more cardioprotective. But in at least one meta-analysis and one or two big trials, there has been a reduction in cardiac events from tamoxifen. So I suspect that what we're seeing is some cardioprotection from tamoxifen and maybe a null effect or maybe a slight negative effect from the AIs, but I would think it's mostly tamoxifen being protective.
How do you manage women who are, 2, 3, 4 years out after having received tamoxifen, or maybe 2, 3, 4 years out, have never had any hormonal therapy? And how do you balance that out in terms of the initial risk of relapse and making a decision?
Yeah. It looks as though the risk of relapse for these endocrine responsive people is steady and goes on over 10 or 15 years, that it keeps on at a yearly rate. And that for people who are node positive, it may be as much as 4% a year. For people who are node negative, around 2% a year. And when you add that up over 5 years or 10 years, it's very substantial. So if I see patients out at that interval, I do approach them about going on an AI in the postmenopausal setting. And I think there's good data from, certainly from MA17, where the women, when the study was closed early, women who'd been on a placebo for one, two, three and a bit years, were offered the opportunity to go on letrozole or not. And about 60 or 70% of them did go on letrozole, 30 or 40% didn't. And the women who went on letrozole got a lot of benefit from that. It's not a randomized comparison, but it looks as though starting letrozole later still gave benefit.
Where are we in terms of AIs in bone?
Well, I think they all are associated with osteoporosis and increased fracture rates. And I think in some studies that's just not quite significant, or it is significant, but the effects look similar from the comparisons to tamoxifen or to placebo in both settings. And we'll start to see soon some of the results from studies that have compared, like MA27 or like the FACE study that's ongoing, that are comparing different AIs one to another. Whether any of them are going to be any easier on the bone or not, I don't think is clear. So I think these women need to be really monitored, have baseline bone mineral densities, be on calcium and vitamin D, be having exercise, and be on bisphosphonates if it's appropriate.
What's your best judgment in terms of if you follow those patterns, what the risk is? Of course, in all the trials, they didn't do that.
Any guess
about how much of this gets abrogated by that approach?
I don't think we know. There are a few trials that show that you can prevent most of the osteoporosis, most of the bone mineral density by bisphosphonates. I don't even think the long-term follow-up of bisphosphonates in bone in well women is all that clear, although that's ongoing. And now we're starting to see some reports of these jaw necrosis cases. And is that going to be a long-term side effect that will become increasingly common over time? So I think there's a lot of information out there we don't know. I'd like to think that if we treated these people fairly proactively, that we could prevent most of the osteoporosis. Well, women who've never had a diagnosis of breast cancer are undertreated for osteoporosis, so it's going to be a big job.
Let's talk a little bit about adjuvant endocrine therapy in the premenopausal patient. Of course, there's a number of trials going on out there that are very critical. What about non-protocol management?
I think for non-protocol management, there's good evidence now that for intermediate or low-risk women who are highly receptor positive, that managing them with an endocrine treatment can be an alternative to chemotherapy. I'm not sure we know exactly what that endocrine treatment should be. I think it could be ovarian ablation in some form. I think it could be tamoxifen. It could be both together. And I guess the most speculative thing is an ovarian ablation with an aromatase inhibitor, which is really very little data. And as you know, there are trials looking at those issues. Those are going fairly well. So we will have good data about that.
I guess there's kind of this inherently maybe oversimplified concept that, well, if AIs work better in postmenopausal women, why don't we just make the woman postmenopausal and give her an AI? Do you think that that is an acceptable regimen outside of trial?
Personally, I don't do it off trial, but I think it makes sense. I don't see why it should be different. I would personally like to see a little data. I have colleagues who do that. And I don't think it's wrong. It's just I'm not quite ready to do that without some data, personally.
Just to kind of finish out in terms of hormonal therapy, let's skip to the metastatic setting. And maybe if you can provide a little bit of an update on where we are with fulvestrant. There's a significant paper presented by Bill Gradishar at San Antonio. Maybe you could start out by talking about that.
The results were presented of the EFFECT study, which has compared exemestane to fulvestrant for patients who have progressed on a non-steroidal AI. And one might have guessed, I would have guessed, that fulvestrant would be more active in that setting because it's a drug of a totally different class. On the other hand, there's been lots of data suggesting that exemestane as a steroidal AI did provide decent response rates or a decent level of clinical benefit beyond the use of non-steroidal AIs. So I think it was perhaps a surprise and perhaps not that exemestane and fulvestrant in that setting appear almost identical, and there really was no big difference. And in fact, as well, when they're compared for side effects, the side effect profiles are very little different either. It was double-blinded, so there were sham injections or placebo injections in the exemestane arm. And obviously, that would make the side effect profiles more similar than the real clinical setting. But I think it tells us that exemestane as a steroidal AI may have more real activity than I might have guessed, but that it and fulvestrant are both alternatives and that they have similar quality of life.
Now, in the EFFECT trial, they use the loading dose, which more people are using now in practice. What are your thoughts about that?
There's good clinical data. There's good pharmacokinetic data that using no loading dose, it takes 3 to 4 months to get up to stable state levels. And so I think most of us have gone to using a loading dose, and there doesn't seem to be any real problem with that. There's lots of safety data about it. I think there have been a number of trials using the loading dose. There don't appear to be any safety problems. I haven't seen details. A lot of the pharmacokinetic data that I've seen presented, I haven't seen published. But I think that data will be published, and I think that's a reasonable approach.
What's your algorithm in terms of sequential hormonal therapy in the metastatic setting, both in the postmenopausal and premenopausal patient?
In the premenopausal setting, I discussed tamoxifen or an ovarian ablation. And for me, an ovarian ablation would be to start the patient on an LHRH analog and get them booked to have a surgical oophorectomy if they're willing for that. And often patients will choose in that setting. I usually discuss the option of having both with them and the fact that it may be a little better, but we're not sure.
Both being
ovarian ablation and tamoxifen. Patients will often have a choice. They may want a temporary ovarian ablation because they may want to preserve childbearing or not go that route fully for one reason or another. They may have a liking or a disliking for tamoxifen for a variety of reasons, previous thromboembolic disease, whatever. And so often I find patients make that choice between one or the other or both. They have a preference and they make that quite easy. In the postmenopausal setting, I would use an AI first unless the patient's progressed on an AI, which is becoming more common. I would use an AI first, followed by tamoxifen, followed by fulvestrant. We're doing a study in our center right now looking at two doses of fulvestrant that puts them on after progression on an AI. So I might do that. But I think one could use these hormones in almost any order in the metastatic setting, to be honest.
Where do you go after tamoxifen and ovarian ablation in the premenopausal patient?
Well, I think once they've had a permanent ovarian ablation, I would generally go on to an AI and Faslodex. And again, there's no data about Faslodex in premenopausal patients, although I think there may be some studies going on of that.
What about neoadjuvant endocrine therapy? We've been hearing about that for years, but not too much seems to be happening. Do you utilize that?
Well, we're doing some studies of it with markers in our center. And you certainly see in these very hormone-responsive patients, high ER, PGR, you see some very dramatic shrinkages with endocrine agents. And we're switching patients between one of two AIs in an alternating fashion and doing biopsies and markers and so on. And then the patients go on to surgery. It also looks as though in the neoadjuvant setting, you see virtually no complete pathologic responses. And that, in fact, responses may take a long time to happen. Most of the time, I don't use endocrine therapy out of a study setting, neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. And most people who do use it only use it for 3 to 4 months, and then the patients go on to surgery. I guess in elderly patients, there's been a number of studies that have used endocrine agents instead of surgery. I think those have tended to show that eventually the patients get poorer control in the long haul. But it's certainly an active approach.
Let's talk about adjuvant chemotherapy. What are some of the clinical research databases, and let's focus first on HER2-negative disease, that have come out over the last 2 to 3 years that you think are most relevant to private practice?
Well, there's just a host of choices in adjuvant chemotherapy, and I think nobody knows what's right. And depending on patients being lower risk or intermediate risk or high risk, we've certainly gone down the track of seeing AC, go to AC Taxol, which is better, and then dose-dense AC Taxol, which is better, and we're waiting for more updated information about that. In Canada, we've used a lot of epirubicin-based regimens, and we now have data from the MA21 study showing that CEF, as we've given it in Canada, is better than AC Taxol given in the 3-weekly regimen, and the hazard ratios for CEF compared to the old 3-weekly AC Taxol, seem to be even better than those seen for dose-dense AC-Taxol compared to AC-Taxol. That's a cross-trial comparison. I don't know how much you can make of it. We're still really waiting for enough events to look at our dose-dense EC followed by Taxol, which is at least as good and maybe better than CEF. And I guess in addition to that, you've got the TACFAC data, which suggests that TAC is a very useful regimen. We've seen data substituting a taxane for Adriamycin in Steve Jones's study, so that comparing AC to TC, and it appears that TC is better. I think there's been a lot of discussion about whether that's a one-shot thing or whether that needs to be verified in other studies.
What do you think?
It's a little worrisome because the other substitution in which a taxane was substituted for cyclo didn't show that difference. And I always do say that the two most active drugs in breast cancer therapy are an anthracycline and a taxane, one or the other of each. So that's a little puzzling, that data. On the other hand, being able to get Adriamycin out of the equation, or epirubicin, although it's less cardiotoxic, is attractive certainly for some patients with cardiac disease, with poor ventricular function, or in the setting of HER2-positive patients, where although the anthracyclines seem to work best there, you've also got to take into account whether you want to use Herceptin and how you can best apply it in conjunction with chemotherapy.
60-year-old woman, perfectly healthy, except she's had easily treatable hypertension. I ask you, okay, what is my risk of my heart being damaged and having it someday be a problem for me if I take four cycles of AC? How do you answer?
I think it's very low, even for a patient with some cardiac history. You probably, if you went around and catheterized 60-year-old women, you'd find that lots of them have some cardiac disease. And I think it's certainly common enough for them to have elevated lipids or elevated blood pressure. I think the risk for patients like that of developing serious heart disease long term is 0.5% for AC. Even with our CEF regimen that pushed up the doses a little bit farther, we saw about 1% serious congestive heart failure, cardiac congestive failure.
What about change in ejection fraction in your study?
We saw changes in ejection fraction, but they're mostly temporary. The ejection fraction seemed to go down and come back up. And they may not come back up quite as high, but many of them do. And it's really hard to know in the long haul, 10 or 20 years down the line, is that going to create a patient who might be more likely to have a cardiac event? As far as we know from follow-up and studies like that, we've not seen that. But are we following people up well enough and long enough? I'm not sure.
Where do you see things heading in terms of clinical research related to adjuvant chemotherapy?
Mm-hmm. Well, lots of questions to look at. I mean, I think there are still some simple questions about the best applications of chemotherapy that aren't answered. For example, and you might call this micromanagement, but I think it's important micromanagement, Kathy Albane looked at, was it better to sequence tamoxifen after chemotherapy, and found that it made a big difference, and that it's superior to give the chemotherapy first and follow with the tamoxifen. No one's asked that question about AIs. There are theoretical arguments as to why it might be better one way or better the other way, just like there were for tamoxifen. That's a trial that I think needs to be done. There's lots of questions amongst the different chemotherapies and regimens that could be compared, and new drugs that may be less toxic that might come into the adjuvant setting. But I guess the most exciting things are the targeted drugs. Herceptin's been very exciting for all of us. And I think we've got lapatinib, Avastin coming down the pipeline, and a number of other drugs just farther back that may come into this area. And I think we'll all be most excited about using these newer drugs and trying to see how we can best put that together.
Where do you see things heading in terms of Avastin in the adjuvant setting?
I guess it depends how much data comes out of the currently ongoing metastatic trials. For example, we've got Kathy Miller's trial now that suggests improvement in progression-free survival, improvement in response rate, but not improvement in overall survival. I think the improvement in overall survival will make moving on into the adjuvant area a much more of a slam dunk. On the other hand, I think it's hard to see overall survival benefits in metastatic trials now. There are so many other treatments that one can go on to and so many useful things you can do that it sort of blurs out. You lose the survival in the noise, I think. And so I think Avastin will go in with other chemotherapeutic agents into the adjuvant setting. And I guess, again, there's cardiac concerns, and how will that fit, for example, with Herceptin, with anthracyclines, which I still think are active and important drugs in adjuvant therapy. And it's a little bit of a puzzle how best to proceed with that. I think there are going to be several different approaches, and we'll have some options.
In your own practice, outside a protocol setting, what chemotherapy regimen do you usually utilize in a node-positive patient, and what do you utilize in a node-negative, lower-risk patient?
Well, I've been using lots of Dostense AC Taxol until we saw the results of our trial. I shouldn't say that that's changed me totally, but once we closed the MA21 trial and we were without a trial for a period of time, I must say I gravitated towards using a lot of Dostense AC Taxol because I viewed it to be in the same ballpark as a regimen like CEF, which we've used a lot in Canada, and less toxic and faster to get in to patients. Now that we've seen our results looking at CEF, and it does look very good, I'm using that more, and I'm now using our experimental regimen, Dostense EC, followed by Taxol. It's shorter, it's less toxic, and it looks as good or better than CEF. In lower-risk patients, I use regimens like FEC 100, AC, CMF occasionally, but not that often.
Another issue that's come up is the question of, again, HER2-negative tumors. To what extent adjuvant chemotherapy is helpful in the ER-positive patient? Can you kind of track that whole controversy out and where we are, particularly in view of the fact that now the overview is starting to bring out some data on that?
Yeah, and the data we've been able to bring out of the overview is, I guess, confusing, and the interpretation of it is controversial. This goes way back into the 70s when people suggested in metastatic disease that chemotherapy worked better in patients with lower ER levels. And I think lower ER tends to be linked with higher proliferation indexes, other aggressive features that may respond better to chemotherapy. So it sort of makes sense. In the adjuvant setting, I think the most interesting thing has been to see these step analyses that look at various levels of estrogen receptor, which are now beginning to make it clear that chemotherapy probably has a bigger effect in lower estrogen receptor level tumors and less of an effect in higher ones. But is that black and white, switch on, switch off? I think that, first of all, that it's probably a surrogate for other things. And secondly, that there's going to be overlaps. So you're going to have patients that are in the middle with a middling level of estrogen receptor, ones that are really high, ones that are really low. Hopefully, some of the new gene signatures will help to point us a bit better around that, but I think that remains to be seen.
Speaking of gene signatures, what are your thoughts about that, and particularly the Oncotype DX assay?
We spent time talking today, and some thought that it was just an expensive substitute for things you could do properly in your own pathology lab if only we would all do them. And other people find it really helpful in their practice. And I think the results of the studies, the TAILOR-X study and Europe, the MINDACT study, that are going to look at how useful those indices are will be really important, but they're not going to come for, what did I hear today, 8 years, 10 years. I'm sure that something like Oncotype DX will be helpful in a small group of patients that we're all on the fence about. We're not sure about the risk, and that will probably be a helpful thing to do. It's not being widely used in Canada at the moment, although we do have occasional patients who get it done. And I don't think it will go into wide use in that setting soon.
Can you talk about the design of the TAILOR-X trial and also the MINDEX study?
Well, the TAILOR-X trial, first of all, is for ER-positive, node-negative women. And if they want to be part of the trial, they first have to register and have their Oncotype DX assay done. And the patients who fall into a very low-risk group will just get hormonal therapy. Those who fall into the higher-risk group will get some type of chemotherapy. In fact, they can be part of another trial. But those who fall into a middle group, and that middle group is shifted down a little bit from what's traditionally been the middle range used with the Oncotype DX assay, those patients will be randomized to either get chemotherapy in addition to endocrine therapy or not. And so that will tell us, for that middle-risk group of people, how much does chemotherapy actually add?
Now, it's been a while since we had a chemo versus no chemo randomization in breast cancer. How do you think that's going to be received by docs and patients?
Well, I think it's more difficult, but it's a group of patients in whom you have that conversation. Do you, don't you? Is it right? Is it not right? And I think we really don't know about them. And while I think it'll be harder than a more close randomization to two arms that are more like each other, I think that patients will accept it. And I think the fact that it's based on exploring the role of a new marker, a new signature, will be attractive to patients. We don't have the trial open in our center yet, but it will be shortly. But I hear from people who are recruiting patients that it's actually going quite well. So I think that'll be good.
When you are going to use chemotherapy in a lower risk, no negative situation, what choice of chemotherapy? Mm-hmm.
AC, CMF. I offer those things as an option to my patients. Most patients will choose a regimen like AC because it's shorter and over with more quickly. Some patients will want to avoid cardiac risk or want to minimize hair loss and will take something like CMF instead.
What about the higher risk patient, node positive?
For me, mostly it's either dose-dense AC Taxol, CEF, dose-dense EC Taxol. FEC 100 is one of those regimens that for me is somewhere in between, but I see it more as being a little bit of more of a lower risk or an in-between regimen.
Let's talk about adjuvant therapy for the HER2-positive patient. What are some of the unanswered questions right now that you'd like to see studied in trials?
Yeah. Well, it's really hard for me to know whether the concept of giving Herceptin with the chemotherapy, how important that is. How important is timing and how important is it to give it with the chemotherapy? Perez's study, the NCCTG study that randomized patients between getting it concurrently and getting it after, suggests that getting it concurrently is important, but that study is odd in that getting the Herceptin after isn't different than the arm that didn't get the Herceptin, that the difference is not there where it is in every other trial. Instead, it's only in the concurrent arm, and I don't know how to put those two pieces of information together. In HERA, for example, although there were some big waits to administer Herceptin because patients completed their chemotherapy and then sometimes radiation, so another 6 or 8 weeks, there's still a big effect from giving Herceptin. If you could have moved the Herceptin back closer to the chemotherapy, would that have been better? I think a lot of us are giving Herceptin now through radiation because it appears to be pretty safe. So all of those things are questions. How long should we be giving Herceptin for? There's this tantalizing result from Heike Yonsu that suggests that a very short duration, I think 9 weeks of Herceptin, is giving a magnitude of benefit that appears quite similar to all the one-year trials. And then we're waiting for the 1 versus 2 year trial. So the length of treatment, and now we're going to move into a setting where we're probably going to compare lapatinib given after chemotherapy to Herceptin, to the combination. And then there's the whole question of where anthracyclines go in the HER2 overexpressing patients. There's lots of data now from ourselves, and there was a big overview presented at San Antonio suggesting that it is the HER2 overexpressing patients who are getting the most differential benefit from an anthracycline versus non-anthracycline containing regimen. And yet those are the very patients where you might want to avoid cardiac damage and maybe give Herceptin closer or with chemotherapy. So now I think the taxotere-carbo regimen will be very attractive to be able to do that because it's been well tested. And which of those approaches is going to be better? So there's a lot of questions around this group of patients.
What about the issue of trastuzumab without chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting?
Well, I suspect it works. And I guess the unanswered question is it better given with chemotherapy? I don't think we know. We know that it's active as a single agent. We know from the single agent trial it had quite a bit of activity in these patients. There's probably an elderly intermediate risk group of people where you might like to give it that way, but there's really no data about it.
What about the patient who has a HER2 positive tumor, but the tumor is node negative? How do you approach those patients?
In my setting, if they fit into the group of patients that went into the HERA or any of the other trials, we'll treat them with Herceptin. So anybody who has a tumor greater than a centimeter, and particularly if they have other high-risk features, whether they're node negative or positive. And the magnitude, the relative effects look very similar in those patients. So the worrisome ones are the 0.9 centimeter tumor with every bad feature, including HER2 overexpression, And in my setting, those patients aren't funded. I think they probably could be candidates for Herceptin, and I certainly often discuss it with them.
What about the patient who has a HER2-positive tumor but in the metastatic setting, and now we're going to start to have this issue of having had prior trastuzumab?
Yeah.
Hopefully lapatinib is going to become available. So that decision is going to start to get a little bit complicated. Where do you think we're heading in that regard?
Well, we all tried to do some studies of continuing Herceptin after progression and switching chemotherapy, and there are still a couple of studies out there limping along asking that question, and I hope there'll be some answers. Because it's been suggested that just keeping Herceptin on indefinitely is good. Now we're going to have the next question, which is if you relapse a year after you completed your Herceptin, should you get it again? And I think that will need a study.
How do you approach the question of post-adjuvant therapy? Is there a time since therapy that would make you not want to use trastuzumab?
If they'd already had trastuzumab and relapsed?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And I would think, you know, an interval of a year or more, and you might think about using it again. But I think we're going to have to do some studies to answer that question, because it's a very expensive therapy. If it's working, great. If it's not working, it'd be better to know.
What about the issue of the patient who has metastatic HER2-positive disease that's also ER-positive? There's been a lot of controversy since the presentation over the last few months of the TANDEM trial. Can you explain what that trial looked at and how you see it fitting into making that decision?
Well, the TANDEM trial was great. It's the first trial that's looked at Herceptin in combination with an endocrine agent, so an AI plus Herceptin or the AI alone. And the AI plus Herceptin had considerably longer progression-free survival, but the progression-free survival was short. I think a difference between somewhere between 2 and 3 months and somewhere between 4 and 5 months, or I may not have those numbers exactly right, but they're short, median progression-free intervals. And I think the stunning thing for everybody is that it's clear that this is a group of women that don't generally respond well to endocrine therapy, even with the addition of Herceptin. But within that median progression-free survival, there's some patients who go into very long responses or periods of stability with the AI and Herceptin. And there may even be some patients who can do that with an endocrine agent alone. So I think the approach to patients like that is if they're relatively asymptomatic and not in a lot of trouble, or if you can monitor them closely, that trying them with an endocrine agent with Herceptin or an endocrine agent alone is a reasonable thing to do. If you try them with an endocrine agent alone and they have visceral disease or whatever, you have to watch them really closely and monitor liver function tests or whatever and just make sure they don't get out of hand. But you could make the argument that on average, this is a group of patients that don't respond well to endocrine treatment with or without Herceptin, and maybe you should move ahead to something more energetic like a taxane plus Herceptin.
Again, trying to put aside the issue of cost and reimbursement in terms of clinical science, what are your thoughts about bevacizumab and where you think that's heading?
Well, I think it's an active drug. It's obviously active in breast cancer. I think both the metastatic studies have shown it has some activity in breast cancer, even if one was just response rate.
And you're talking about the capecitabine
study. Yeah, everyone's called that a negative study, but I think when you double the response rate, that's... Bernie Fisher used to use the expression, this has produced a perturbation in the natural history of breast cancer, when he got these effects that weren't very big and everybody said, so what? He said, what we know is we're perturbing the history of this disease. And that's how I see that.
And also those responses were adjudicated pretty strictly.
Yeah, I think when you adjudicate responses strictly, it's hard to see high response rates. But that doubled the response rate. And now in combination with Taxol, progression-free survival is affected as well. I think almost whether you see overall survival or not in that setting, that Avastin is going to be active. It's shown to be active now in colorectal cancer and other diseases, and I think it will go into the adjuvant setting. We're all going to turn back into internists. We're going to be monitoring people's bones and their blood pressures and their hearts. It's good.
What about the issue in terms of first line versus second line versus third line therapy in terms of bevacizumab? The trial, the one that people point to, the bevacizumab Taxol trial, was first line, but often there are patients out there who haven't had the drug or in the second, third line setting.
I think that you always see more effect when you get these drugs up into first line because the patients are just more responsive in general and they're not so sick and so on. But I would think it would be reasonable to use that drug farther down the line.
Any thoughts about the mechanism of action with bevacizumab? There's a lot of debate about that. Of course, nobody knows. Any sort of personal pet theories?
Well, it's presumably acting by an anti-angiogenic mechanism, anti-VEGF mechanism. But I think there's sufficient preclinical data to suggest that it may also act by some other pathways. It's very, very interesting to see these anti-angiogenic drugs. I guess one of the ones that impressed me the most is seeing Sutent in renal cell carcinoma. And I don't normally treat renal cell carcinoma, but in my institution, we've had a huge study going on with renal cell patients because of one of my colleagues. And these patients with this very vascular tumors that are very advanced, and they just shrink. They just shrink away because the vessels just shrink. And some of them, unfortunately, bleed and so on because they've got a lot of intra-abdominal disease and the vessels shrink away so fast. It's like treating a lymphoma in the GI tract with really active chemotherapy and where you can puncture the GI tract or perforate the GI tract. And so I think these agents are really active against vasculature. And whether they also work by other pathways, I think it's possible, and I think it's going to be very interesting. It would be nice to know if there's a group you can target, like for Herceptin, there's a proportion that get a big response and some that don't get any. On the other hand, if it works in everybody, that would be nice too.
Where are we in terms of identifying predictors? Of course, we have the neoadjuvant studies that are starting up now, like the NSABP study, looking to see if we can find something, anything promising?
I think we're pretty much out there looking at a broad spectrum of markers at this point. And I think the neoadjuvant models are great. We've been doing some work in our own setting with looking at models for resistance for epiribocin and taxotere in the neoadjuvant in locally advanced inflammatory disease, actually, and we can get biopsies at the beginning at 3 months of therapy and 6 months of therapy and so on. I think there's going to be some extremely interesting work come out of this sort of approach.
Where are we heading in terms of the next generation of trials looking in HER2-positive patients in the adjuvant setting? There are two major trials out there. Where are we right now with that?
One big trial that's on the table, formerly called Aphrodite, now called ALTO trial, is one that'll be designed a lot like HERA. So it's going to look at patients who've completed chemotherapy and they'll be randomized to either a year of Herceptin, of trastuzumab, a year of lapatinib, a year of both, or I think what started out to be 6 months of Herceptin followed by 6 months of lapatinib, but I think now it's actually got something like 4 months of Herceptin with a little clearing period and then the lapatinib, so the sequence of the two. That's one trial that's going to be going on. NSABP and BCRG together are going to be doing a trial that will look at the TCH combination and adding Avastin or not, which I think will also be really interesting. So that's two really different approaches to those groups of patients. And then when we get to the other end, we'll have to put those two approaches together, which is going to be a challenge. But I think it is exciting that we have these targeted drugs, though, and that we're moving also into an era when we are finally collecting tissue and really hopefully having the funding to be able to explore targets and markers. Very expensive business in tough times for research money, but I think that will be really important.